Ronald Moss from Midland County. Texas Natural Resources and Conservation Commission versus Tammy White from Young County. And KXU Electric Company and others versus the Public Utility Commission of Texas from Travis County. Court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present the law argument. In these calls, petitioner or appellant may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a recess in between each argument and complete the arguments before lunch. Justice O'Neill is not here today, but she will participate in the deliberation and decision of these cases. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase an audio tape for a nominal fee of any argument from the clerk. We're ready for the argument from petitioner in Shaw versus Moss.
May it please the court, Mrs. Barbara Bauerfriend will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Barbara Bauerfein. I'm here on behalf of Harshad G. Shaw. He's the petitioner in this case. This is a medical malpractice case. We appealed this case to this court because the Court of Appeals in El Paso, the 8th District, reversed the case based on the statute of limitations under 4590I, the medical malpractice statute. It is our contention that this action was barred by the statute of limitations, and the court erred in reversing on that basis. I would point out a couple of things. When we initially filed a summary judgment motion, what we had before us was an allegation of an unnecessary or negligent surgery on a date certain, November the 28th, 1992. There's no doubt about that date. That's when the surgery took place. The first report from their expert, Dr. Moore, the entire report was in essence saying that surgery should not have been performed. The scleral buckle, the medical device that was placed on the retina, shouldn't have been removed from the eye. We don't think there's any doubt that statute of limitations as to surgery runs from the date of that surgery.
Excuse me. Are you saying that there was a different affidavit other than one that's included in our appendix here, and that the affidavit which talks about course of treatment, that it was the combination of the follow-up care and the surgery that caused the plaintiff harm, is not what we should be looking at?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that there's an affidavit and there's a report. The report came first.
Mm-hmm.
And in the initial report, Dr. Moore said was that it was negligent to take that scleral buckle off, that removal surgery shouldn't have taken place. Then after we filed our summary judgment motion, they came forward with an affidavit from Dr. Moore.
And that's what we should really be looking at, is the affidavit at that point in time. At this point in time, the report is immaterial to our determining whether or not there's a fact issue on the question of limitations.
Okay,
is that right?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I think you consider both, but it doesn't make any difference.
Well, no, but I just understand procedurally what you're asking us to look at. If we have a summary judgment motion, you filed evidence in support of it, there's controverting evidence that's been filed by the plaintiff, then that is, in fact, the summary judgment record that we look at determine whether or not there's a fact issue on the question of limitations, correct?
I think that's correct, okay. Your Honor. I would point out that we did reply and supplemented our motion for summary judgment twice to address those matters and to specifically address the affidavit that was filed.
Right, but this affidavit is what we look at with respect to the plaintiff's controverting proof as opposed to the report.
I don't disagree with
okay.
that, Your Honor.
Okay.
I just
wanted to make sure that I understood.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You.
Yes, ma'am. As I said, as to the surgery, we don't think there's any doubt that occurred on an ascertainable date. As to what was added in the affidavit to which the court has referred, in our opinion, that affidavit, the essence of it is that there was a failure to order follow-up treatment, follow-up visits on the basis that Dr. Moore would have it done. He says that you either do it weekly or monthly. He would have this patient come 52 times a year or 12 times a year. Well, that's not what Dr. Shaw's medical decision was.
And was there any follow-up treatment?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where does it show that in Dr. Shaw's affidavit?
He lists the dates in his affidavit. Also, it's pages 160 through pages 164 in the clerk's record.
What does that show?
What that shows is follow-up visits.
No, is that his affidavit on pages 160 through 164?
No, that is the part of the medical record that shows the medical charting of those visits.
But here's what I'm curious. Looking at his affidavit, he lists these office visits which followed the surgery. The office visits were December 8, 92, January 8, 1993, February 18, 1993, May 6, 1993, October 21, 1993, and November 22, 1994. And he says, after November 28, 1992, I was not provided continuous treatment for any condition of the plant. He doesn't say whether or not any, all, or none of those were ongoing treatment follow-up visits for the surgery.
He doesn't say that because that's not what they were. In his practice, he's an eye surgeon, and he just does rechecks after the surgery's done.
Which one of those were rechecks?
As is shown on page 164, his schedule is basically to do a one-week recheck, a two-week recheck after the surgery, then a one-month recheck, then a three-month recheck. That's typed on these forms. And then at that three-month recheck, down at the bottom, when that visit actually occurs, on May the 6th of 93, which is page 162 in the clerk's record, down at the bottom, he made a medical decision as to when he needed to see that patient
again.
You're
saying that the May 6th, 93 was a three-month recheck?
Yes, it was delayed. If you look at page 163 in the clerk's record, it was originally scheduled to be earlier than that, but the patient is an elementary school principal, and he delayed some of his visits because he was busy at school with school matters. And so that got delayed a number of weeks.
But if the court determines that there is a duty for continued follow-up care, then a competing affidavit on what you're supposed to do, you know, 1 week, 1 month, 3 months, or a 52-week deal, that just creates a fact issue on the issue of whether it's a standard of care that's followed, right?
Well, what I'm saying, Your Honor, we're not contesting whether or not he should see this patient again. What we're saying is the medical decisions were made on those days with respect to when he needed to next be seen, or whether you ran this test or ordered some other test for him, much like the cancer cases.
So you're saying there's a date certain based on once he decided that he didn't need to see him the next several months, then that's negligence. Well, one of the difficulties I may have here, let's assume there was no negligence in the surgery. But the standard of care is to have follow-up checking, because even without negligence, I assume the medical community assumes that something could happen, and either because of physiological circumstance of the patient, they don't heal as easily as others do or something. They just assume, even without negligence, you've got to have follow-up care because something may happen. Well, if that scenario is proper, then is it possible that no injury occurs even though a medical decision may be wrong? In other words, I make the medical decision that I don't need to see this patient for 3 months. The patient has no injury at the time I make that medical decision. But because of the physiological circumstances of the patient, 2 months into it or 1 month into it, the surgery falls apart. And there is an injury. I mean, the injury didn't occur at the time the doctor saw it because the patient had no injury. This is a problem where the injury occurs after the doctor makes this medical decision. I'm wondering if you can determine when the negligence occurred. Wouldn't the negligence have occurred at the 2 month time when another doctor said, well, wait a minute, no. You've got to check it every 2 months because there's this possibility out there that might exist. And so the negligence occurred not at the time I made the decision not to see him for 2 months, but at the time that I didn't see him in 2 months, and that's when the injury actually happened to the patient. If you'd seen him 1 month before, they wouldn't have had any problem. If you'd seen him a month after, it's 30 days after they had it.
Your Honor, respectfully, I think that would be contrary to what this court has done in the failure to diagnose the cancer cases. In those cases, what the court looked at was the last date prior to the diagnosis of the cancer that the doctor could have ordered a biopsy, mammogram, whatever it was.
But weren't we dealing with the standard of care that said when you see a patient, you have a duty to check on it, and therefore, having not checked on it, the negligence occurred. But I'm talking about just a follow-up care. The follow-up care is required simply because you had surgery, not because there's a risk. I mean, I guess it's because there's a risk out there. that this surgery just may not take. So there is a duty for follow-up care. And the reason you have follow-up care is because at some point in time, you might find it, you might not find it.
Well, I don't think it's really that different from the cancer cases in that if the woman comes in with a lump in her breast and you check it and you don't find that it's cancerous at that time, does that mean you never see her again? Or in the cases that this court has heard, Hussein versus Khatib and Bala versus Maxwell with the stomach cancer case, what this court said, in essence, that there was some sort of duty to follow that patient, yes. But what it said is you look at the last date prior to the diagnosis as far as the last date that the doctor was negligent in not ordering some level of follow-up that he failed to order. They have said that my client failed to order weekly or monthly follow-up for this patient. Well,
and they're entitled to do that for purposes of making an allegation. And since our focus here is on limitations, let me ask you, do you agree that Dr. Moore's affidavit indicates that his complaint about the care and therefore the basis of the claim that you contend is barred by limitations is the combination of the performance of the surgery without adequate follow-up care?
Yes.
In other words, okay, so they're not separate events. He is in fact viewing it as one thing. Surgery plus follow-up care is what led to the harm, and that's what was negligent.
That is his allegation.
Okay. All right. It's not a question of, I mean, the surgery in and of itself wasn't negligent. It's the surgery plus the follow-up care. So this is a course of treatment case.
I don't think this is a course of treatment case.
Well, then what is it?
Your Honor, it's a alleged negligent surgery on a date certain, but and then a failure to order follow-up after that surgery method that this particular expert says should have been ordered.
Well, why isn't that a course of treatment for a particular condition? Surgery plus follow-up care. Let's look at the Kimball case, for example, in which this court indicated for the first time that the way we review the provision of the malpractice limitations statute is that we look at the date certain. And in that case, we had a hospitalization. We had an allegation of negligence against the anesthesiologist. And so the court said, no, we're not looking at the end of the hospitalization because there's one day the anesthesiologist treated, that's when negligence was. Why is this more like that kind of case than a course of treatment case if you agree that the allegations that are made or is it that was the combination of the surgery and the follow-up care or the lack of follow-up care that amounted to negligence?
Because this court has said, and a number of the courts of appeals have said, just because an expert says it was continuous course of treatment, it may or may not be. That's a legal decision. And in this case, we have huge gaps in him even seeing the doctor. He's got good vision and a retina that is attached. He's not having any problems. This guy is coming out for just rechecks.
But that's a question as to whether or not we've got negligence in this case. For purposes of summary judgment, aren't all the inferences to be made against your client and in favor of the non-movement?
But, Your Honor, what you look at is when do you know that there is a problem, okay? And we know that for sure. That's on November the 22nd, 1994.
Well,
there's a detached retina diagnosed that day, 6 days short of 2 years.
On November 22nd, 1994?
Yes, sir.
All right. So if he was he had no injury, basically, until November 22nd, 1994. Is that your position?
It is our position he didn't have a physical injury until then, but it is also our position, as stated in our brief, that he has a legal injury on November the 28th of 1992,
What would he have sued for at that point in time? I mean, what would his petition have? Because he didn't go blind until 1994. So what would you sue for if after the surgery in 1992?
In his pleading, he pled a breach of an oral medical services contract. And he said he had a contract with the doctor in November of 1992 that he would leave part of this medical device on the back of the eye, part of that scleral buckle.
Okay,
and that somehow that was to afford some protection so that he would not have a detached retina.
Okay, and you've already won that claim. That one's out of the case.
Well, you have won that claim, Your Honor,
Let's go back to the negligence claim, though. His claim is that he went blind as a result of surgery and the combination of surgery and failure of follow-up care. And it was not until the retina detached and it was unable to be repaired, apparently, to the point where he lost his sight. That occurred in 1994. And you're asking us to impose a limitations period that would have cut off his cause of action before that damage actually occurred. Is that what you're asking us to do?
No, I'm not asking the court to do that.
Then I'm unclear about that. That's the way I read your brief, so I really would appreciate your explaining it.
Okay. No, what we're saying is he had surgery on an ascertainable date, and then there are 5 follow-up visits before you get to the visit where the injury is diagnosed, the retinal detachment has been diagnosed. We're saying that if the court wants to, they can look at the surgery separately, as in the Shook case, the court did, and then looks at the follow-up separately. Or you can put that all together. You can put the surgery and that amount of the follow-up together, and you still get to October of 1993. October the 21st, 1993, would be the last follow-up visit at which he could have ordered this weekly or monthly follow-up that is allegedly going to prevent this retinal detachment.
Just a quick question. You mentioned the legal injury, and it seems to me the Liability Act, doing away with the discovery rule, simply says that once the legal injury occurs, the tort is complete, and there's no delay on when you have to bring your cause of action. And the tort is complete on the date that the negligence occurs, seems to me. And that seems to be your argument. But in fact, if the retina has not detached at that last visit, there would have been nothing to have diagnosed at that last visit, nor had there been a legal injury occurring at that last visit. So doesn't that present a kind of an interesting problem here? If there is no negligence, assuming you cut out the cause of action for the negligent surgery, you simply have negligence in follow-up care, and an injury results from negligence in the follow-up care, you still have to have the permission of a tort, it seems to me, for the statute of limitations to run, and find that it has to be a legal injury that occurs. What is the legal injury that arises from a failure to diagnose a condition that does not exist?
Well, what they're saying is that he should have ordered this follow-up to prevent that retinal detachment from occurring. And that's the negligence they allege. And the last date that he could have done that prior to the actual diagnosis of that retinal detachment, that's October the 21st of 1993.
Yeah, but the physician-patient relationship continued until sometime in 1996. There's no claim, 1995. There is no claim that there was that the physician-patient relationship was discontinued in October 1993.
No, Your Honor, we don't claim that.
The physician-patient relationship continued, and the ongoing duty continued to exist between October 1993 and November of 1994.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. I'm just saying he made a medical decision on October the 21st to not have weekly or monthly follow-up.
And the problem I'm having is that in order to have a completed tort, there must actually be a legal injury. There must actually be some damage. Maybe not all the damage, but some damage. And the damage that is alleged in this case is the detached retina, which is alleged to have occurred from removing the scleral buckle and then failing to adequately monitor and follow up in order to prevent a subsequent detachment. So I am having a hard time understanding how the tort could be completed and how you could have a legal injury before that retina detached.
Basically, Your Honor, on the legal injury claim, I don't base my whole argument on that. That basically comes out of Jennings versus Burgess, where this court recognized that the negligent referral was made on a date certain, and just because the patient went to this physician to whom she was referred, it wasn't the plastic surgeon or the specialist that she asked for. The limitations ran from the date that medical
that was
decision
the end,
was made.
That was the end of that doctor's treatment of that patient. That was the
That's
end
true.
Of the physician-patient relationship at that point in time. So nothing that doctor could have done after that point in time made any difference.
That's true.
Another question.
Yes, I need to ask a few more questions about these dates. You said that the last scheduled follow-up visit that was established by Dr. Shaw was May the 6th, 1993, correct?
And at the bottom of that one, Your Honor, you'll see where it says RE and then a check mark and it says 1 year. So he was going to see the patient annually after that. That was the medical decision he made.
And the purpose of seeing him annually was what?
He is an eye surgeon, and that is just, he just sees these patients once a year if he's done any surgery on them. Whether or not they're having, he was not having complications, didn't have a post-operative infection, nothing like that. But that's just his procedure.
And he was going to see him annually both in October of 93 and November of 94.
Your Honor, he says that in May of 93. The patient on his own comes back in October, 5 months later, because he's had some floaters, and he wants the doctor to check it. So he was not really scheduled to come back until May of 94, but he comes in early.
I'm talking about, let's go back. You're saying that after the surgery occurred, Dr. Schopp said, my standard procedures require X number of follow-up visits to ensure that post-op everything is okay, and that those visits concluded on May 6, 1993.
Yes, that's the three-month visit, but it's delayed because of the
correct
patient's schedule.
At what point in time does the record show Dr. Shaw prescribed or requested that the patient come in October of 93?
He did not request that the patient come in October of 93. The patient did that on his own because he was having some floaters.
Okay, so the October of 93 visit had nothing to do with what Dr. Shaw required or requested.
That's true. That's just the last date prior to the retinal detachment that the doctor could have ordered anything that he didn't order, whether it be weekly follow-up, monthly follow-up, whatever.
And the November 22 of 94 visit was not scheduled by Dr. Shaw.
That was scheduled by Dr. Shaw. That was to be the 1 year, but it got delayed from October of 94 because the patient's busy schedule. He lived 40 miles from Big Spring, was 40 miles from Midland. He's an elementary school principal, and he had to delay some visits. But that was the annual visit that should have been 1 year after October of 93, but was delayed due to the patient's schedule.
So the November of 94 visit was part of, let's say, the package follow-up with regard to the original surgery.
That was the annual rechecks that he does on these patients.
But he doesn't do annual rechecks like, let's say, a person goes in and sees their eye doctor on an annual basis. They didn't go see Dr. Shaw for this because he was seeing his other doctors for that. He was seeing Dr. Shaw on November of 94 for the purpose of follow-up with regard to the eye surgery. Is that correct?
That is his procedure was to do annual rechecks, whether or not the standard of care requires that or not. That was his procedure.
But here's what I'm trying to figure out. Was that annual recheck related to the surgery?
It's not necessarily related to the surgery, Your Honor. You're dealing with a patient who has a history of retinal detachments, and so he would just see these patients once a year. But if he did any surgery on them, then he had closer together follow-up visits.
Would he have seen the patient on November of 94, regardless of whether or not the patient had surgery?
He would have seen this patient annually from some date starting back in 91 when he put that bubble on the eye, if he had never removed it. He puts it on, I believe, in June of 91. Under his scheme, he would have done these closer together follow-up, the 1 week, 2 week, the 1 month, and the 3 month, and then go to an annual schedule. That's what he did for these patients.
Here's what I'm trying to figure out, and I'd like to answer this question. Let's assume that a course of treatment began with the surgery in 92, and that part of that course of treatment included the preset follow-up visits. Your contention, one of your contentions seems to be looking at the language of the statute, the health care treatment for which a claim is made was completed on May 6, 1993. For reasons which I don't understand, you argue, I think, that the course of treatment was completed on October 21 of 93. Here's what I need to figure out. Why would it not be fair to say that the course of treatment for the health care problem was completed on November 22, 1994?
Your Honor, I'm not contending that there was a course of treatment. What I am contending is that there was a surgery and some routine recheck visits. And what the doctor's looking for is to see if there's any kind of problem. We're dealing with whether or not there's any effects of that surgery.
Then answer this question. You're saying that there was surgery and some recheck visits. On those recheck visits, why would it not be fair to say that the November 22nd, 1994 visit was one of those recheck visits?
It is a recheck visit, Your Honor. But if you're going to use a course of treatment analysis when you've got visits 13 months apart, long distances apart, then you're never going to run the statute of limitations from the date of the breach or the date of the tort. You're not dealing with a case where you've got a patient taking the medication that you're monitoring,
But the breach that's alleged in this case is that if he was going to perform that kind of surgery, he shouldn't have allowed 13 months to go by without checking the patient. I mean, that's the whole point, is that this particular surgery, and given this man's condition, required follow-up. And I know you disagree that that wasn't required, but that's the allegation that is put before us that we have to deal with. So, I mean, the fact that there's a 13-month is the gap during the course in treatment that's alleged to be a breach of the standard of care. Isn't that what the allegation is?
That is part of their allegation, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that's too large a gap to apply continuous treatment doctrine, or whatever you want to call that theory, to this case.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Denise Smith will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, Your Honors, my name is Denise Smith, and I'm here to represent Ronald Moss, who's the respondent. And before I turn to what I was going to say, I'd like to come back and answer a question that Your Honor was asking counsel, and that is, the question was his annual recheck related to surgery? The answer is yes, Your Honor, it had to be.
Where is that in the record?
The record reflects, and it's in the medical records in our briefing, and I don't have the number off the top of my head, but basically he is an eye surgeon. That's all he does. So it has to be related to the surgery. The record reflects that he was seeing ophthalmologists, he saw various eye specialists, and he was referred to this doctor in his own records because he is an eye surgeon. The letterhead on his clinic, where he's on his records, show that he does surgery, and that's all he does.
I thought I recalled from the briefing that the November 94 visit wasn't a visit due to any preset concept of the patient coming back to visit the doctor, but was a visit at the behest of the patient because the patient was experiencing problems. In other words, it just kind of came out of the blue as opposed to being related to the ongoing checkups set by Dr. Shaw.
Your Honors, I understand the records, and as I understand the plaintiff's expert's affidavit, rechecks are really important for retinal surgery because of the danger
that
for it to happen.
I'm not quarreling with that.
Okay.
And I'm assuming that certain rechecks are part of the treatment and follow-up of surgery. What I'm trying to figure out is whether or not this November visit was one of the rechecks or was unrelated to the rechecks and was something, let's say, spontaneous by the patient who recognized that he was experiencing further difficulties and thought, man, I need to go back and see the doctor.
You're talking about November 94?
Yes.
Okay. What I have in the records, and it's at the court's, the clerk's record at 127 and 398, and it's under our tab C, Your Honor, in our brief, because we have basically, we put together a chronology of the course of treatment. And it says in at those points in the record, and I don't remember anymore whether that's our client's affidavit, Mr. Moss's affidavit, which he filed in the record, or the medical records, or both. But it says he's not experiencing problems, but he sees him on a regular routine checkup. Dr. Schaub diagnoses another retinal detachment, and he schedules surgery, which comes up less than a month later.
I'd like to talk to you about the legal injury argument that Justice and others have asked you a question about. It looks to me from the briefs that the doctor put in evidence, summary judgment evidence, that your client had eye problems, decreasing vision as early as June of 93. That he, after he had seen Dr. Shaw in 93, before he seen Dr. Shaw, and after he had vision problems. What evidence did you put on in the record about when his injury occurred? His injury from Dr. Shaw's treatment.
Well, first of all, with all due respect, Your Honor, because this is a limitations case in summary judgment, we do need to respond, but it's their burden.
Well, they put on evidence, it seems to me, that he had a legal injury as soon as June of 93, and I'm saying, what evidence did you put on that controverted that?
Well, if I understand the court's question, and could I ask you to repeat it again, because I'm not real clear.
Some people seem to be concerned about that his legal injury didn't occur until he actually had a retina detachment. But it seems to me from reading Dr. Shaw's brief that they put in summary judgment evidence that, no, he actually had problems with his eyesight, an injury to his eyesight that he now says is attributable to Dr. Shaw as early as June of 93. What evidence did you put in that, no, the first time he suffered a coverable injury from Dr. Shaw was what date? What evidence did you put in on that would controvert or raise a fact question that his legal injury occurred as early as June of 93?
Your Honor, that would be Mr. Moss's affidavit, which he filed in response to summary judgment. It's about a 2 or 3 page affidavit where he talks about what he experienced and when, and how he didn't go blind until December. And did he have
expert,
eye problems?
What expert testimony did you put on to controvert the other expert's testimony that his eyesight was starting to fail or having problems as soon as June of 93?
I guess that would be our expert's testimony about the follow-up, that there were two things that were wrong, that he should have taken off the scleral buckle and the follow-up.
And what did your expert say about when that actually injured the patient?
He didn't say, and that's the problem in this case, Your Honor.
Do you contend the legal injury accrued?
Your Honor, we don't know. And that is the problem. And
but there's summary judgment evidence, so what did you use to controvert that?
The problem with continuing treatment, Your Honor, is that it's really difficult to tell. And if we did know a particular date, then this court's opinion in Kimball versus Brothers would apply, where we said, hey, everybody knew it was on this date. Somebody died. Some event happened that we're all really clear on. What we have is a man with bad eyesight going in, getting it corrected, it deteriorating again, it getting better, deteriorating again, and eventually, 2 years later, he goes blind. And that's why continuing course of treatment works, Your Honor.
Well, that's my second question. Your client saw him on October 21st of 93, and that was the last time he saw Dr. Shaw before Dr. Shaw diagnosed detached retina.
Sometime in 93. I'm not sure exactly the date.
Why didn't the negligence occur then? Because Dr. Shaw didn't then say, I need to see you every week or every month. Wasn't that when the negligence occurred at the very latest? It was October of 93.
The negligence was ongoing. From the time he removed the scleral buckle, the negligence was ongoing. That's what our expert said.
But the last time that he saw him before he clearly had a problem was October of 93, and that's would have been the last time for him to have told the patient, you need to come in weekly or monthly, and that's he failed to do that on October of 93. So why isn't that the date of the negligence, the last day of the negligence, the latest possible day of the negligence?
Because Dr. Shaw continues to treat the same eye, continues to see the same eye for the same problem.
But the next time he saw him was the time when he discovered he did, in fact, have a detached retina. So don't we have to look before that to see when the negligence occurred?
Well, Your Honor, I would ask the court the question, what was his injury at that point in time?
In my response to you, there's evidence in the record that he was injured as early as June of 93, and I'm asking you what evidence you put on to say, no, he was not injured in June of 93. He was not injured in October of 93. His injury was sometime after October of 93.
That would be shifting the burden.
But they've come forward with evidence. And so unless you controvert it, why don't we take that evidence as true?
Because it is the doctor's burden to negate to negate whatever defense we have to limitation.
But they comes forward and puts on evidence that you were injured certainly before October of 93. And you don't controvert that. Shouldn't we take that as true, that yes, he was injured before October of 93?
Well, the evidence that we have, Your Honor, is that the injury was ongoing. And so perhaps I'm just not understanding the court's question. The injury was ongoing. Our affirmative defense to limitations was this is continuing treatment. He continued to see him. He continued not to follow up as he should have.
If the injury was ongoing, when did it start?
That's the rub, Your Honor.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
Certainly.
What's your position?
My position is that we don't know, because when he took off the scleral buckle, then this patient was at risk.
Don't you claim it started with the surgery in November of 92?
Well, no, Your Honor, because of this.
There was nothing wrong with that surgery? But that was your claim?
Yes, that is part of the claim. That is part of the claim.
So
but the problem
then
is that the second half, the injury, doesn't happen until the retina detaches again. And we don't know when that happened. Mr. Moss doesn't know when that happened. And certainly the petitioner can't tell you when that happened. We don't know when that
but
happened.
But you think it happened as a result of the November 92 surgery?
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
So that's when it started.
That's when it started. But the tort was not complete, if you will.
But let's assume, consistent with what Justice Heck is asking about, that it's irrelevant when the tort is complete, because the way the statute reads, it says from the date of the breach or the tort. So we can look at the earlier of the two. And what we're looking for is, when did Dr. Shaw breach the standard of care? And consistent with what Justice Heck was just talking about, when do you consider was the time, the latest time, when Dr. Shaw breached the standard of care by failing to prescribe further checkups?
Let me answer that in two parts, Your Honor. First, let me go to the statute, and that is, with all due respect, the court recited a part of the statute. The statute does say in the first part it's the occurrence of breach or tort, but then there are two other clauses to that statute. The second one, which is the continuing, part of the continuing treatment clause, says the day the medical or health care is completed. So what I'm saying is it's the second clause of 4590I, section 2.01, that we take advantage of here, because we can't tell when the occurrence of the breach or tort happened, because we had a surgery, but nothing bad happens. We don't want anybody suing doctors when nothing bad happens. Just because the doctor is negligent, if there's no completion later on, why would we want anybody suing doctors?
When is the latest date that you contend Dr. Shaw should have recommended further follow-ups?
I don't have an answer for that for this reason, because we don't know when the detachment happened.
Did you? Because the records show that Dr. Shaw made this 1 year plan at the time of the surgery, or did he decide that after each visit, when the next visit was going to be?
Your Honor, I do not recall the record reflecting the reasoning behind that.
I mean, we know that. We do have this one notation about see again in 3 months, but we don't know.
I don't know what happened.
That was a normal routine that was decided at the time of the surgery.
I do not know that for a fact. That would be outside
secondly,
the record.
You contend that Dr. Shaw's interpretation of the statute violates the fictitious constitution.
I say that it does if this court doesn't find continuing treatment. I'm saying we don't need to get to unconstitutionality. If this court finds continuing treatment, that this case was continuing treatment. And we say that if there is a continuing treatment, it's this one, where no one can tell exactly when the tort was completed.
Can going to the question of legal injury, can a legal injury occur merely from an act that increases a risk of injury? Let's assume that the surgery is, let's assume there's alternatives to this surgery. You either take the buckle out or you don't take the buckle out. And the follow-up care is dictated based on the decision of whether to take the buckle out or not take the buckle out. And suppose that the doctor makes a decision, I'm going to take the buckle out, and then does not do the follow-up care that another physician in the same practice would say you need to do because of a difference in the risk that occurs. You're taking the buckle out, there's a different kind of risk now exists, and so you have a different kind of follow-up care. Can there be a legal injury that occurs at the time the doctor makes a medical decision to do a follow-up care that does not meet the medical standard of care? Has the legal injury occurred because there's a recognition of the increased risk from the type of surgery that's performed without this kind of follow-up care? You understand my question? You argue about a detached retina.
Yes, sir.
Your doctor's affidavit seems to imply that if you remove the buckle, you're increasing the risk of a subsequent detached retina.
Yes, Your Honor.
The argument is made, well, there seems to be some eye problems and that sort of thing, but your argument really is the risk is a detached retina. That occurs when they take off the buckle, but it's a risk that's dealt with by follow-up care. Seems to be the implication from the doctor's, your doctor's affidavit. Can a legal injury occur because of that increased risk? Or must the risk actually be suffered to have a legal injury?
I think I understand Your Honor's question, and I would argue that the tort has to be completed. That a legal injury hasn't occurred just because a patient is at higher risk if actually he doesn't suffer damage. And indeed, I would hope the law is that way, that doctors or lawyers or anybody couldn't be sued even when they do something wrong unless there's harm, unless the tort is completed, unless there's damage.
But are you saying that in November of 92, if he had not removed the buckle, then there's no risk of a further detachment, or that that buckle, if it's still there, prevents another detachment at that time?
Your Honor, I wouldn't argue either way because that would be arguing the facts. And that would,
well,
that would
I
mean
thought,
being a medical doctor.
Seems to me most of the discussion is about the buckle and what that procedure brought on for the months and years that went after that. So if the basic statement is if he left the buckle in, the second detachment wouldn't have happened, don't we have a specific date for an erroneous medical decision in your client's view on November 28th?
Well, we do have an erroneous medical decision.
Right, so that is a date certain for purposes of limitation under the Act. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor, it's not a date certain because nothing bad happened then. So,
but if the alternative to that question is if you had left the buckle on, nothing would have happened anyway, where are we with that set of facts? If the operative thing that happened is the removal of the buckle, if he'd just gone in and said, I'm going to leave it because it'll keep you from having another detachment, then the decision to take it off is the malpractice, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor, for this reason. Admittedly, and I think the record is pretty clear medically, that a second retinal detachment can happen anyway. And so, yes, one is at increased risk.
He'd already had one, correct? Which is the
purpose.
That's
exactly, before he ever got to this position, absolutely.
And that's the purpose of putting the buckle in, is to prevent a reoccurrence.
Absolutely. And if the doctor decided to remove that for whatever his reason was, obviously our expert says, you shouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have done that. That's negligent.
All right. So that and is an act by the doctor that's contrary to the standard of care of your expert witness.
Right.
Which translates to be a negligent act. Isn't that correct?
Is it a negligent act in and of itself, or your opponent says that you're alleging that it's a negligent act only when coupled with the lack of follow-up care?
That's right.
If you remove it, but you do adequate follow-up care, right, then it may be okay to remove it. If you remove it without the follow-up care, then it wasn't okay to remove it. That's what I read your...
Yes.
Do you agree with her that that's your...
Yes, that is pretty much what we're saying.
So
for this reason,
whether the surgery is negligent or not depends on what happens afterwards.
Absolutely, because the increased risk determines whether or not he's going to have a retinal detachment that cannot be repaired. He may have one anyway, okay? But it's the repeated follow up. The record reflects that if one catches a retinal detachment soon enough, that it's like basically like wallpaper peeling off one's eye. It's like wet wallpaper. And so if you catch it early, then you can fix it.
So it's your position that your expert's affidavit and your petition in this case raises a claim that is different from some other cases in which the surgery and the acts associated with the surgery can be separated from what happens after the surgery.
Absolutely.
In this case, you're saying that it's all inextricably intertwined, and it's what happened afterwards that makes the determination of whether or not the surgery in and of itself was negligent.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And my time has expired. Could I answer your question more fully? Specifically, what we have here, Your Honor, is we have Gormley versus Stover, but...
That's what I read here.
Yes.
Do you agree with her that that's your...
Yes, that is pretty much what we're saying.
So for
this reason.
Whether the surgery is negligent or not depends on what happens afterwards.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because the increased risk determines whether or not he's going to have a retinal detachment that cannot be repaired. He may have one anyway, okay? But it's the repeated follow-up. The record reflects that if one catches a retinal detachment soon enough, that it's like basically like wallpaper peeling off one's eye. It's like wet wallpaper. And so if you catch it early, then you can fix it.
So it's your position that your expert's affidavit and your petition in this case raises a claim that is different from some other cases in which the surgery and the acts associated with the surgery can be separated from what happens after the surgery.
Absolutely.
In this case, you're saying that it's all inextricably intertwined, and it's what happened afterwards that makes the determination of whether or not the surgery in and of itself was negligent.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And my time has expired. Could I answer your question more fully? Specifically, what we have here, Your Honor, is we have Gormley versus Stover, but we actually have what this court said that Mr. Stover didn't have. This court told Stover that he had no case. Justice per curiam told him he had no case because all he had was a surgery, but nobody had alleged that there was bad follow-up. And so we brought to this court both. We have a surgery that probably shouldn't have happened, and even if it did happen, then we better follow up really quickly so we don't have either.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Baroff, you mentioned something during your argument that created a question for me. If you look to the discrete event, and say that that's the last time the doctor saw them, even if the injury at that time didn't exist, and you say that's when the time runs, can you think of an example where there'd be a hospital stay where the date of the completion of the service couldn't parse the doctor's visit the day before is the last time the doctor saw him, and then they're discharged from the hospital the next day as being the date the doctor failed to do whatever the doctor was supposed to do, right? Couldn't you parse every medical service in such a way that you could pinpoint a discrete act from which you could claim the negligence occurred, even though the statute says there's this other date out there, which is discharge from the hospital or discontinuance from treatment? Couldn't you parse the conduct in such a way that you could produce a different, an exact date?
As I read the court's opinions in this field, if you can come up with a breach or a tort on an ascertainable date, you go from that date. If you can't, then you look at those other two clauses. And what we're saying, Your Honor, is that there's an alleged negligent or unnecessary surgery. I really think what he's saying is it's an unnecessary surgery. It shouldn't have been done at all.
But if you divorce the breach from a legal injury or the tort from a completed tort, meaning a legal injury, and if you divorce it, it seems to me in any circumstance you could find the discrete act. You could always point to the minute and the hour the doctor did or did not do something. It seems to me that the only way the statute that allows these other dates would have any meaning is because we don't know when that retina detached. And as a result, there may be a period of time after it detached that a negligence might have occurred. And so it's when the treatment ends as opposed to the discrete act that the doctor committed. Isn't that the way that statute ought to be looked at?
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. What I say, looking at the court's opinions in this field, is that you look at the breach or the tort. You don't look at the date of injury to make that determination. And if you find an ascertainable date of a breach or a tort, you go from that date.
But in most instances, the injury occurs on the date of the breach of the tort. For example, doctor negligently performs a surgery and takes the wrong leg off, amputates the wrong leg. I mean, typically, we have an injury at that point in time. Correct?
Sometimes you don't. Where you have the radium treatment and she finds the hole in her bladder 4 months later.
But that's the discovery rule as opposed to the question of whether when the tort is complete. The injury, the hole, or the injury, whatever, actually occurred at the point in time that the surgery was performed. What place do you believe that the continuing treatment prong of Section 201 plays in medical malpractice jurisprudence?
Your Honor, I think that applies if this patient had some sort of surgical complications, so you kept having to, like the one of the cases cited was an eye surgery case, and the incisions were too deep, and so they had some post-surgical complications. There are also some cases dealing with post-op infections, where you have to keep treating and give them antibiotics or that sort of thing. But where you're just dealing with the effects of the surgery, not some infection,
What's the difference between an effect of a surgery as opposed to an infection from a surgery for purposes of course of treatment? In fact, the doctor has to still treat for the effect of the surgery in terms of providing appropriate follow-up care as part of the surgical treatment.
May or may not. The doctor may determine that there's no need to see this patient again unless the patient makes some complaint.
Try me again so I can understand your position. I'm having a hard time understanding your position on what role the course of treatment prong of 201 plays in limitations jurisprudence.
As I said, I think that applies to such things as where a medication is prescribed for epilepsy, that sort of thing, and the doctor's supposed to keep monitoring the effect of that medication on the patient. And see the patient at some interval. It would apply if we had post-surgical complications. It would apply if we had a post-surgical infection. We don't have any of those things here, Your Honor. We have a patient with good vision for a period of time, detached retina.
Looking at the summary judgment posture of the case, how are the scenarios that you just explained different? I know you disagree with the allegations and whether or not they're factually true or not, but how does that differ from the factual allegations in this case? If a person who has a history of retinal detachments has a scleral buckle removed, that what is required is appropriate follow-up in terms of frequent follow-up because the patient is at greater risk. How is that distinguishable from the follow-up to make sure the medication doesn't cause some complication? What's the distinction?
To me, the distinction, Your Honor, is that what they're saying in the initial report, and they're also saying in the second, the affidavit, that taking that scleral buckle off at all shouldn't have been done at all. And at the end of their first report, he talks about removing that buckle started a process.
I want to go back to you gave me some examples of what you think would be continuing treatment cases that involve surgery. And I just explained to you why I'm having a hard time understanding the distinction between what the allegations are in this case and what Dr. Moore has in his affidavit and the examples you just gave me. They claim increased risk from doing this surgery that mandated, in order to meet the standard of care, ongoing and continuing follow-up care because of the increased risk. Why is that any different than following up with a patient who you prescribe medication to because they're at risk for complication from the medication, or they've had an infection and they're at risk for the infection coming back? You've explained that those are continuing treatment cases. How are those cases distinguishable from the allegations that are made in this case?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that as long as you have ascertainable dates of alleged negligent acts, breaches or torts, it doesn't make any difference, number one, whether it's a continuing course of treatment. That's what this court has said. If you come up with the ascertainable dates, and what we're saying is those ascertainable dates are in this record, and the last date that this doctor, whether you want to lump the surgery together with those post-op checkups or not, but the last date was October the 21st of 1993, and no suit was filed within 2 years and 75 days.
Why do you consider that October 21st date to be the last date?
Because the retina detachment was diagnosed at the very next visit on November the 22nd of 1994.
Why don't you consider some date before October 21st to be the last date?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The last date for... I didn't understand your question, Your Honor. I apologize.
What you said October 21st was the last date. What were you referring to?
That's the last date that he made a medical decision how often to see this patient prior to the injury.
And why do you consider it to be the October date instead of the May date?
You're talking about the May of 93?
Yes.
It is true that the patient had started having vision problems I believe it's May or June of 1993. And in fact, the vision goes from something like 20/30 to 20/80 by February of 94. But then he doesn't go back in to see Dr. Shaw until November the 22nd of 94. And Dr. Shaw finds that same 20/80 vision. So the detached retina probably occurred sometime before February of 94, because that's when his vision dropped off.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.